Well, essentially, the reason I started Puerto Rico Forward was because I believe that the issue of Puerto Rico gets, of course, a lot of coverage in Puerto Rico, in the archipelago. And it's a very important issue for the people living here. And I feel that for this issue to be resolved, for the issue of Puerto Rico to be attended to, another party also has to be informed and interested on this subject. And I think that party is the people of the US, the people of the United States. So Puerto Rico Forward is an effort of bringing information to the people of the US so that they are able to interact with this subject in an informed manner and for this subject to finally be resolved, because Puerto Rico is an issue and it needs to be tended to.
Andrew, what would you say is the core issue? What is like the crux of the Puerto Rico problem or issue that Americans don't understand?
Well, that's a complicated question, because you can divide a people's existence basically into two subjects, which is culture and economics, essentially. And within economics, you can also apply law. So in order for me to answer that question, you'd have to tackle one of those two at the time. I think the most approachable one would be the economics and the legal structures that have created Puerto Rico's situation. I think those are much easier to approach because they provide a common ground between the two parties that I mentioned before. So the center of Puerto Rico's issue from an economic and political standpoint is truly its status. Its political status and the way that it's been formed and it's been created in order to serve a certain purpose, a certain colonial purpose, which in essence and in a nutshell is to be a thing. Puerto Rico is treated as a means to an end. It's not treated as a place. It's treated more like a legal instrument. So Puerto Rico, for some laws, can be treated as a state. For some laws, it can be treated as a foreign jurisdiction, and that's only possible because Puerto Rico is an unincorporated territory, which is a legal term basically created by the US Supreme Court. That means that Puerto Rico belongs to, but is not a part of, the US. So from that legal reasoning, you can basically do anything with Puerto Rico within certain extreme limits. And that's very, very important when you're talking about colonialism, because colonialism needs to be flexible enough to serve the interests of the colonial owner. So Puerto Rico's political status, in my opinion, is the most basic and fundamental issue that needs to be resolved, basically.
And Andrew, in your podcast, you say that the purpose of colonialism is exploitation, and that's essentially what the United States is still doing with Puerto Rico, is exploiting them.
Well, yeah, I mean, the reason why I use that phrase is because it's the best way to describe a relationship where one entity, one on the one side you have Puerto Rico that's subject to Congress's territorial clause and plenary powers. And on the other side you have Congress itself that basically is in the driver's seat of Puerto Rico's destiny. So when I said that it's being exploited, I'm using that phrase very purposefully, because from the point of view of anyone that's able to approach this subject with a clear head, what you observe is that Puerto Rico's economy and the way that Puerto Rico's development has been shaped is essentially to grow dependent on the US's economy. So you have a situation where Puerto Rico produces and Puerto Rico's labor force is usually used for the benefit of the US, and it also consumes from the US's output. So the exploitation comes from that relationship where Puerto Rico's economy in its activity is basically geared towards providing wealth for the dominating colonial overlord, if you could say. And it's also used to consume from the outputs of the U.S.'s markets. So that's where I see the exploitation happening in a macro level, and that's why I use that phrase.
What's happening on the micro level? What do you see?
Well, I mean, at the level of individuals, that's when you start entering that other subject I mentioned earlier of culture. I mean, that's much more complicated. But to answer your question, what I see is a lot of people here in the archipelago wanting change, and a lot of people growing conscious of an unfair relationship. And at the same time, I see a lot of people growing conscious of a level of ignorance that's present when we try to talk about this subject outside of Puerto Rico. And at the macro level, and the micro level, I think that that's very useful, because what that means is that people here in Puerto Rico are becoming aware of themselves and becoming aware of the need to tend to this issue. So from the micro level, this type of situation, this type of relationship has basically been exasperated to the point that people are waking up and seeing that it's not sustainable. You can't have a whole population, a whole society living on the weaker side of a colonial relationship.
And this has to do, Andrew, with sovereignty too, doesn't it? Puerto Rico has no sovereignty, does it?
No. Essentially, it doesn't have sovereignty of its own, which is the reason why it can't solve its own problems. Puerto Rico doesn't have the necessary legal tools that would allow any other population defined as a nation to be able to address its own needs and to be able to address situations like the ones we're living in right now, like the current economic crisis. We actually have tried. One case that comes to mind is when Puerto Rico legislature tried to actually enact a bill that would allow it to restructure its municipal debt, which includes the government agencies. And it was actually basically stricken down by the Supreme Court, because at a federal level, federal bankruptcy law didn't allow Puerto Rico to have its municipalities have protection under Chapter 9 bankruptcy code. But that same law also didn't allow Puerto Rico to enact its own code, its own bankruptcy method. So there you have a clear example of the level that Puerto Rico doesn't have the sovereignty and doesn't have the power to address its own issues, even if it tries, even if it wants. So there you can see how Congress is truly driving Puerto Rico. I mean, Congress has complete control over Puerto Rico to the point where it can leave Puerto Rico without a remedy, without any tools to deal with its own financial crisis, where Puerto Rico isn't allowed to use Chapter 9 bankruptcy, and at the same time, it's not allowed to create a bankruptcy system of its own. So it's placed in a limbo. I use the term legal limbo, where it can't do and it can't not do. So Puerto Rico, it's missing that essential part, that sovereignty, in order for it to be able to address its own issues.
So, Andrew, from the United States point of view, why don't we allow Puerto Rico to become a state? Wouldn't that solve some issues?
Well, again, that's when you start jumping into that cultural element of this story. I mean, of course, there are economic considerations to have. One of them is that by maintaining Puerto Rico what it is now, which is an unincorporated territory, you have that amount of flexibility. As I mentioned before, Puerto Rico right now can be used in some respects. It can be considered as a state in some laws, and it can be considered as a foreign jurisdiction in others. And usually that consideration of it being a foreign jurisdiction is very pleasing to large economic interests, because by having Puerto Rico be a foreign jurisdiction, there's certain tax flexibilities that you wouldn't have if Puerto Rico were a state. So it's actually more beneficial to keep Puerto Rico as it is right now, because Puerto Rico offers something that you really couldn't have otherwise, which is a flexibility of one single place being in some laws a state and some others a foreign jurisdiction. If Puerto Rico becomes a state, you lose that flexibility, and Puerto Rico's purpose of being a colony is also lost, because you no longer have that amount of power in deciding Puerto Rico's future. Because being a state, Puerto Rico would have representation in Congress, and it would have a voice. So it wouldn't be so useful anymore.
Andrew, I guess probably some of the reasons are the same, but why do we not grant Puerto Rico independence and let them become their own country?
Well, I mean, as you said yourself, it's basically the same reasonings. And listen, I don't want to try to attempt to climb into the mind of every member of Congress. I don't want to try to say that I know exactly why these things are what they are. But if you look at the way that Puerto Rico has been handled throughout its relationship, if you call it that, with the U.S., what you see is a constant use of Puerto Rico's legal limbo, Puerto Rico's colonial status, for whatever purpose best serves Congress's interests. And if Puerto Rico becomes a state, or if Puerto Rico becomes an independent country, you'll lose some of those benefits from the point of view of being able to treat us however is better for Congress or for the interests that be. Now, of course, you could have an independent Puerto Rico that economically depends completely on the U.S. And you could also have a situation where the U.S. can receive some type of preferable treatment in some type of international treaty between an independent Puerto Rico and the U.S. So that could happen, but I think that the cultural implications of having a 51st state that speaks Spanish and having that type of situation within the United States of North America has some cultural implications as well. So I'm not able to answer that question fully without entering into those deep waters of cultural identity.
Sure.
That also have a play.
Yeah. One thing you said, which I thought was incredible that I had never thought of, is that legally we have the right to sell Puerto Rico. We could sell it to the highest bidder. Talk about that a little bit. Why don't we do that? Why don't we sell it to China, you know, for $50 billion or something?
Well, I mean, from the point of view of the buyer, you also have to consider who would buy, especially at this stage. But from the seller's point of view, Puerto Rico is a valuable asset for the United States economy. I mean, in 2008 alone, the difference between the money coming in from the U.S. and the money coming out from Puerto Rico to the U.S., the difference was over $40 billion being injected into the U.S. economy through Puerto Rico's consumption and other economic interactions. So I believe that specific report, which was under the Clinton administration when he enacted the task force to try to handle Puerto Rico's status issue, I believe that was a show of force, a way of actually establishing how far-reaching Congress's power of Puerto Rico truly is. But from that to actually having a situation where the U.S. would place a price on Puerto Rico and ask someone to buy it, I believe that would just be a bad deal for the U.S., specifically because we've been 120 years in this situation, and the U.S. has always had that power. So if you're stuck with something for 120 years, knowing that you can sell it at any time, you must be getting something good out of this.
Sure, yeah, we're getting something from it, so why change the deal?
Exactly. Why try to fix something that's not broken from that from their point of view? They're getting a lot of economic activity out of us. So why change that?
Yep. So Andrew, switching to some current events, I mean, Puerto Rico is broken, isn't it? Tell us briefly about Hurricane Irma and what it did to the archipelago there.
Well, there was two hurricanes. First was Irma, which brushed us through the north, and it caused damage, but it wasn't nearly as much damage as Hurricane Maria did. But it was basically a 1-2 punch, where the first was kind of a slap, and then the other one really knocked the wind out of us. From the point of infrastructure, Puerto Rico suffered a great deal, which was unnecessary, because if Puerto Rico and its politicians weren't in this vice, in this cycle of creating more debt to finance their own, to finance the government's activities, we wouldn't necessarily be in such a bad situation, because instead of constantly running a government-level Ponzi scheme of issuing debt to pay off other debt, you could have had investment in infrastructure, could have had investment in revamping the electrical grid, but that didn't happen. And the reason that that didn't happen, in my opinion, is because Puerto Rico's economy is not geared towards investing in itself. Puerto Rico's economy is geared towards pleasing foreign capital. And the way that you please foreign capital is issuing a lot of tax exemptions. So when you issue a tax exemption, that's income the government isn't receiving. And if you don't have that income coming in, but you still have costs, well, you can either raise taxes, print money, or issue debt. Puerto Rico can't print money. Politicians don't want to raise taxes because that doesn't allow them to be elected. So the government basically issued lots of debt for decades. And that did not allow Puerto Rico's government, Puerto Rico's activities to be focused on itself. It was basically running on a Ponzi scheme. So that money coming in, because it was issuing debt, wasn't invested in Puerto Rico, but it had to be used to pay off old debt and old interest on those bonds. So essentially, Hurricane Maria, what it did was show us the real world direct implications of having an economy that serves other interests that are not of the people. So Hurricane Maria was a huge lesson. Puerto Rico suffered unnecessarily because of that. But if anything, Hurricane Maria was a wake-up call. And a lot of people have seen that. And from the point of view of someone that's living here, I'm grateful for the amount of people that have been able to see this frustrating and very difficult and hurtful lesson in that way, as a wake-up call.
And Andrew, we hear reports here that it's a dynamic has taken place that Naomi Klein calls disaster capitalism, that not only has Hurricane Maria revealed some things, but that private companies are taking advantage of it, of the disaster, to privatize more and really make it even worse. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I mean, I believe that she's right in her thesis, in her general thesis. You know, at any point that there is a disaster happening, people move in and try to make a dime off it. Puerto Rico is not the exception. And one of the best cases to see how that's being highlighted in Puerto Rico is with its power authority, which in the States, is, you guys know it as PREPA, Puerto Rico Energy Authority, if I'm not mistaken. So essentially, when the lights went out after Hurricane Maria for months, immediately, like it wasn't even a week, I believe, maybe a week and a little bit more at most, talks about privatization already started and already became the focus issue on bringing power back. It was basically a huge campaign from the government and the private sector to privatize and sell off the Puerto Rico Power Authority. And it was a move that I see was very well-placed from the point of view of someone that wants to buy the Puerto Rico Authority, because it plays on the people's needs. It plays on the people's immediate desire to have power and to not have to be living in these conditions where you don't have power, you don't have, in some cases, running water because there is no power. Remember, Puerto Rico has mountainous regions, so water has to be pumped up, and that requires electricity. So some people, because they didn't have power where they live, they also didn't have water, and that just drove further sympathy for privatizing the power authority. So I would believe that she is right. I think that the situation in Puerto Rico is a bit more nuanced than simply saying investors come in, try to buy things when situations go south. I think the case of Puerto Rico requires a little bit more of a closer look than saying that. But of course, I haven't read her work specifically about Puerto Rico. So maybe she did go into detail about that. I don't know. But I believe that the conversation about Puerto Rico and disaster capitalism is specifically complicated because of Puerto Rico's history with the U.S. and because of that type of relationship that has always driven Puerto Rico's reality. You know, we've always seen ourselves as dependent on others to come in and try to solve the problem because we've never had the power to do it ourselves.
Yeah, sure. With no sovereignty and no power, you have to be dependent on others. So, Andrew, what is the current situation there now? Is the island coming back? Is it frozen? And talk about the protests which have started recently. I know we're all interested about what those are about and what's happening.
Well, from the point of view of the general feeling in Puerto Rico and its people is, first off, frustration, where we feel frustrated at the fact that we were so vulnerable. And as I said before, so unnecessarily vulnerable. One thing is to be subject to forces of nature you can't control. And another thing is for you to suffer the consequences of having a government, an economy that doesn't work for you. And by having those things that are supposed to provide a certain level of security, social, at a social level, and those things not working, that natural event, that hurricane coming in, basically exasperated everyone's feelings about those institutions that have constantly failed us. But I do need to point out that through living a crisis, one of the things you learn is that no one's coming to save you. And that attitude can drive people into two directions, in my opinion. Either they give up or they do it themselves. They stop waiting. And in Puerto Rico, one of the most beautiful things in this type of situation with Hurricane Maria was seeing Puerto Ricans, people in Puerto Rico living here, actually going out and clearing their community, bringing people together and making a plan so that they could get through this. Complete roads were actually opened up so that government agencies could come through at the hands of the people living there. Like, there was no, in some places, there was actually no pause in thinking there, you know, someone else is going to come and help us. No, they actually got out their machetes, they got out their chainsaws, everything that they had, and people of all ages started working to rehabilitate their own communities. So that's one of the cultural aspects that I see playing out in Puerto Rico, where the spirit of a people that have suddenly realized that no one's coming and that the game is actually played in favor of someone else, not you, comes to rescue, truly. So the experience of Maria has brought a lot of hope to me, And I've seen how a lot of people have used this experience to learn that it's in our hands. And that translates into a national consciousness and a desire to move our nation forward that I'm not sure it would have been there if it weren't for such a tragedy and such a situation that actually forced us to see ourselves that way. I'm not glad Maria happened. I'm not glad so many people died. And I'm not glad so many people lost their house. But if that situation was going to happen, at the very least, having a reaction like this one of waking up and at least at the community level, taking control and doing a grassroots movement, that's at least a positive. That's at least something that can be looked at as a silver lining.
And is it that waking up and development of consciousness behind the protests? Talk about the protests a little bit.
Well, the protests were a reaction to, first off, the Oversight and Management Board, which in Puerto Rico we call it the Junta, that management board that was created through the Promesa Act, that basically was a reaction to the very fact, as I mentioned before, that Puerto Rico didn't have a way of organizing and reorganizing its debt. As I mentioned before, Puerto Rico doesn't have access to Chapter 9 bankruptcy, so its municipalities can't declare Chapter 9, but at the same time, it's precluded of doing so. It can't do it itself. So it's left in this gray area where it can't do anything. So Promesa, the way that it was justified is that you had this bill that needed to create an oversight and management board that could come in and straighten things out. And it provided also a type of bankruptcy proceeding. And that oversight board, of course, it was charged with the mission of putting Puerto Rico's financial situation in order, quote unquote, and this one's important, having Puerto Rico regain access to markets so that it could go back to issuing and selling bonds, for example, or other types of debt. So in order to do that, what the Oversight Management Board has done lately is that it's been approving certain fiscal measures that would basically remove a lot of the rights that workers had fought so much to gain. And it's promoting austerity. Lately, the local government has served kind of an antagonist to the Oversight Board's desires. Like, essentially, it's basically opposing it because it sees the Oversight Board as a threat to its government power. But on both sides, local government and the Oversight Board, you have policies of austerity being constantly promoted and moved forward and approved. So on May 1st, as happened last year, this year, May 1st, you had protests happening in the financial sector of Puerto Rico, which we call La Milla de Oro, which translates in Spanish as the Golden Mile. So various groups organized a march, and it was actually planned beforehand, the routes and where they would meet up, and it was all basically, it had been announced. So it wasn't a surprise that these groups met up there. It wasn't a flash mob, for example. But it deteriorated. The protests and the people there and the police basically ended up in a scuffle. And a lot of people in Puerto Rico and in the media are pointing out that the police actually did something known as kettling, where you actually get a group of people and you place them in such an area where they can't really escape easily. So what that does is it provokes anxiety and it provokes confrontation, inevitably, basically. And that's what you guys maybe in the States saw, you know, those visuals of protesters getting shot at with tear gas and having nightsticks fall on their heads.
Right. That's what we saw. Yeah.
Yeah, it was basically an event where it has repeated itself in the past. You know, the Puerto Rico police is actually under a federal monitor, under the Department of Justice, federal Department of Justice, and it's been so, I think, since 2010 or 2011, because of its violations of civil rights and its discriminatory practices. Unfortunately, of course, not the whole police department isn't like that. But the type of police unit that confronts crowds like that in Puerto Rico is known as a Fuerza de Choque, and it's a special unit. And they're unfortunately have been characterized, and the ACLU is now investigating this, and a federal judge actually issued an order to investigate what happened here in May 1st. They're basically pointing out that the police violated people's civil rights. So it's a story that has happened before, but I'm glad that it's getting some type of coverage in the mainland USA, because I think that allows this conversation to actually happen at a larger scale, which is necessary for it to be addressed.
Andrew, as we conclude, what do you see as the path forward for Puerto Rico? What would be the best case scenario in this difficult situation?
Well, from the point of view of economics, Puerto Rico has to, first off, look at its tax code, for example. Puerto Rico has to take an introspective look from a legal standpoint and see what its fiscal policies, its economic policies have done. Puerto Rico first has to do that, has to accept that this fetish towards foreign capital and trying to attract foreign investors to Puerto Rico only exacerbates Puerto Rico's dependency. I think that's the most immediate and most logical step. But of course, as I started off saying, Puerto Rico's political status needs to be addressed, and Puerto Rico can no longer be a colony. It can no longer sustain its existence as a territorial property of the U.S. And Congress needs to be honest with the people of Puerto Rico to what extent it would allow or accept a 51st state, and to what extent and under what conditions it would allow independence. Because you cannot ask me to make a decision that will affect my children, my grandchildren, every generation going forward without you telling me what your deal is. I need Congress to be honest and tell me under what conditions it would accept me as a 51st state and under what conditions it would grant independence. And the path towards having that conversation has already been specifically described through a constitutional status convention, which I've talked about on my program. So the path towards getting Puerto Rico at least out of this legal limbo is a necessary first step to define its future, but it can't happen if both parties aren't having a conversation and being honest with each other. And by both parties, I mean the people of the U.S. and the people of Puerto Rico through their governments.